Hello, everyone in Ricochet. Hello, hello. I'd like to welcome you very, very warmly to the first ever episode of the Levy and Council Show. I'm Judith Levy, and I'm speaking to you from Israel, where I live. And Damien Council, whom you'll be hearing from in just a minute, will be speaking to you from his home country of England. We are here to share with you our thoughts, our observations on current events in the U.S., U.S. policy, the American-Israeli relationship, what's going on over here, why it's relevant to you over there, how things over there look from here and from England and from Europe and all kinds of other things that I hope will be interesting. We're so glad you're here and hope that you enjoy the podcast. Damien Council, hello. Let's hear your voice.
Hello, Ricochet listeners. Yes, I'm Damien Council. I was born in Africa. My mother's from Sierra Leone, and I was born in Nigeria, but I grew up in the UK, and I studied at universities in the UK and worked as a scientist in the UK and now work on the web. And much of the stuff I've done, whether it's science or web work, has involved traveling around the world. I think of myself as I am... often put it as a left liberal neoconservative. So please be kind to me, because I'm probably a long way to the left of you when it comes to domestic matters, and possibly to the right of some of you, or at least more interventionist than a lot of you when it comes to the matters of international relations. Mm-hmm. And I've known Judith for a long time, as I've also known Claire Belinsky, who is another prominent Ricochet contributor. If you're going to be nice to me, I'd just like to let you know that I'm nice to people who I consider conservatives, not least of all the ones on Ricochet who I've found to be more civil and open-minded than in a lot of other places where conservatives gather on the internet. Which isn't to say that people on the left are renowned for being open-minded and civil on the internet, but I think partly out of choice, partly because people pay to use Ricochet, and partly, of course, because you have a code that you enforce. It's mm-hmm. a place that I find a very interesting window on people who view the world from to one side of where I stand, I think.
Mm-hmm. One point I'd like to make about Damien is that, as you'll observe from his photo on Ricochet, he's very, very good looking.
Thank you.
And he has, this is, of course, what's important, and he has perfect teeth. But lest this arouse any suspicions among you, I assure you that he is an authentic Englishman. He is not putting on the accent for credibility. So just as long as that's clear.
I was going to say that what you can't see in that photo is my lower teeth, which all lean slightly to the left, appropriately. But go on, yes, you were going to say?
No, just quickly about myself. Ricochet people, I think, are already familiar with me. I have been writing for Ricochet for quite a while. But just for anyone who's new, I am an American. I'm a New Yorker. I moved to Israel 11 years ago. I have one Israeli husband and three Israeli-American children. I studied international relations at Oxford. My particular interest is Israeli, or was, still is, Israeli military history. I was at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy during the Oslo era, and now I'm a Mideast analyst and a contributor at Ricochet. So, Damien, let's jump right into this. Let's talk briefly about the election. I completely immersed myself for months and months and months leading up to the election in commentaries that were looking forward with warm anticipation to Nate Silver getting a public comeuppance. And this was a huge vindication for him. So, please explain what happened. What did we get so wrong? How did we get it so wrong? And what can we learn from this?
Well, I wouldn't presume to tell you guys where you got things wrong. I mean, a very similar thing happened on the British left back in 92, when a lot of left-leaning, a lot of Labour supporters in the UK persuaded themselves that a Labour victory was inevitable. And when it turned out to be very much otherwise, a lot of people, both on the left and the right, were surprised. But there were pollsters who were telling, who had correctly predicted what was going to happen. Nothing like as many, and nothing like as well, as Nate Silver had done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is all credit to him for not letting this turn into a triumphalist Revenge of the Nerds period for him. I mean, I saw him being interviewed by New York Times representative and being very, very modest, even at the stage when it was clear that he had scored 50 out of 50. It has to be said, other pollsters, other aggregators, the model builders who had followed similar methodology but different methodology. Basically, they'd trusted the polls to the exact correct extent. And I think that's one of the most striking things about the kinds of approaches that people use, which are quite common in science, but possibly less common in the media, is that it wasn't so much a case of them predicting things exactly. It was a case of them knowing how much to trust the data that were available to them. And I think that's one of the interesting things. I think, at the risk of doing what I said I wasn't going to do, maybe I can suggest some reasons why people thought the way they did before they were shown to be wrong. I mean, even I, as somebody who had a lot of faith in the approach that Nate Silver and others were taking, thought there would probably be some shy Republicans, just as there were in the UK a lot of shy Conservative Party supporters, people who, when somebody phoned them up or invited them to fill out a form, would say that they were going to vote
The Bradley effect. Bradley effect.
Yeah, they were going to vote for the nice guys, people who were perceived to be the nice guys. And you'd expect that to be even more pronounced in a situation where there's a racial element, where people presume that by not choosing the black guy, you may be saying something about black people, when in fact that's clearly not the case. Mm-hmm. And so even I thought that there was a possibility there. But what was very interesting was that there were people who thought there was a systematic bias in the media, in the pollsters, and with the analysts.
Mm.
And there's, to a certain extent, you have to say that if somebody believes that, they're suffering slightly from a kind of paranoid mindset. I know it sounds like a rude thing to say, but it's something that people on the left in the UK suffered from in 92. And I think if you've been out of power for a reasonable length of time, it's understandable. You do tend to feel the world's against you, especially if the world really is against you, in the sense that the popular vote leans in the other way. It leans the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another part of it is that the story that a lot of people in the media wanted to tell was much more interesting than the story that the numbers were telling.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers were telling quite a boring tale, and newspapers need to tell interesting stories to sell, and mm-hmm. television programs need an interesting story to sell. Mm-hmm. And that's a temptation that's very difficult to resist wherever you fall on the scale. And the people who thought that Nate Silver himself was biased might want to pay attention to some of the things he said about, for example, global warming. I think one of the interesting things about people like Nate Silver is that they go, like a good scientist should do, go where the data leads them. Mm-hmm. And they make a point of telling people not to let their emotions get in the way. And Nate Silver has come up against Michael Hockeystick Man, who I'm sure is something of a bête noire with the Ricochet readers, because he's taken a very pragmatic economist's style approach to questions to do with anthropogenic warming. And I think that gives you a good example of how he has a healthy distance from what he's doing. And of course, mm-hmm. as it happened, the outcome showed that he hadn't allowed his judgment to be clouded. I'm being told here that my connection is breaking up, so apologies to anybody who is having difficulty hearing me. But yeah, the essence of what happened was that he was right. And the essence of what happened was was the Republicans lost, and they lost in the popular vote, and they lost in the Electoral College. And they lost, not catastrophically, but they did lose badly. I think it's converging on 2.5% or something like that as a difference. And the question of what to do next is a very good one, and it's not one, again, that I would presume to answer in an ideological sense. For example, I can think of some practical things that have come out from what I've read about what happened. I'm not one of these people who is tempted by the more glamorous suggestions people have about, oh, well, this is it's all about young people, or it's all about women, or it's all about the social media and the internet. Yes, it's impossible to ignore the racial demographic element. I don't want to get too bogged down in that now, because that's not something about which Republicans can do much practically, except perhaps by choosing a minority candidate the next time around. But one thing that everybody has to concede is true about elections is that polls don't count, Facebook likes don't count, retweets don't count, but what does count is votes on the ground.
Mm-hmm. So the ground game, it all comes down to the ground game. Mm-hmm.
Indeed. And the brutal numbers of this, the Democrats had twice as many field stations as the Republicans. Mm-hmm. If what I've been reading about Republicans' attempts to modernize their customer relations management systems, if you like, computer databases that they use to chase up voters and get them to polling booths, if what I've read about that is correct, it seemed to screw up in some ways this mm-hmm. time around. And so there are two very, very obvious things that can be fixed right there. Republicans, I mean, ironically, given that, you know, the candidate was a famous Bayer consultant whose MO was to parachute in and mm-hmm. fix things technocratically for God knows how many different firms and organizations and famously the Olympics. Ironically, it seems that they didn't quite get the engineering right. And somebody is going to have to do that for the Republicans if they're going to win again.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Don't panic is another thing I would say. I think, I mean, one of the interesting things that comes out when you look at electoral cycles all around the world in mature democracies is that there's a slow drift that takes place over time against incumbents. Mm-hmm. Now, the danger when you've lost badly is to throw everything up in the air and try to change things in a radical way, thinking things are badly wrong, we've got to change things significantly to make them right. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I mean, you don't want to, I mean, the classic message of the loser politician is we didn't get our message across. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Republicans should take comfort in that. I don't think they should reassure themselves with that, because that's what conservatives in the UK did throughout Tony Blair's dominance here, and that didn't work for them. You mm-hmm. know, apparently popular positions they took, perhaps most relevantly on immigration, did not pay off for them. And they ended up changing their positions, and they ended up changing their presentation as a group of people rather than as an ideological bloc. I mean, one thing I was talking to Judith about earlier on is there was a long, strong perception in the UK the Conservatives as the nasty party. And this is something that David Cameron fought hard to shift. Now, what that meant wasn't so much that he had to change policy. It was that they had to persuade people that their motivations weren't negative motivations. And that's very difficult to do if you're led by a very rich person. If your candidate is conspicuously wealthy, there's a subconscious perception that he's greedy, and there's a subconscious perception that anybody who votes for him is also greedy. And that is unfair, but it's real, and it's something that has to be dealt with. One of the real advantages that you have in the United States compared to the United Kingdom is that people who make a better life for themselves, people who get on in life, are generally viewed more favorably in the US than they are in the UK. And I think that is something, again, when it comes to the practicalities of choosing a candidate, it might be wise for Republicans to have in mind, which is that I don't think your voters mind so much voting for a rich guy if he started out as a not-so-rich guy. And if that person also happened to be a member of a minority, I really do believe that that could make a massive difference that has nothing whatsoever to do with ideology.
Well, this is part of why I can't help but feel optimistic about the slate for 2016, because there are some really, really exciting, promising, young Republican people out there who are, you know, the obvious one who leaps to mind is Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who not only does he kind of fit the demographic and also the image that you describe of coming from very, you know, tough beginnings. Parents were Cuban immigrants. In addition to that, fold into that, he is a wonderful, wonderful speaker, so much so that when I hear him speak, it's reminiscent of 2004 era Obama. He's the kind of guy who gets up there and, you know, he holds people rapt. And so much of this, I think, in the wake of the election, I feel so much of this really ultimately had nothing to do with policy. It had nothing to do with message. It was all about emotion. It was all about a kind of basic gut level affiliation and a desire to be affiliated with a certain image and absolutely not to be affiliated with another image. It goes back to, you know, this drives me crazy that this even is a real metric, but it is a metric, which is this who do I want to have a beer with nonsense. But it's real. It's real. And, you know, it's ironic in the case of Obama, because you might want to have a beer with him, but he almost certainly doesn't want to have a beer with you. I mean, this is a guy who doesn't even like glad-handing his own donors. You know, he's uncomfortable getting his picture taken with people who've just given him $1 million. And also, you know, he is an aristocrat. Over the summer, I read Jody Cantor's really fascinating book, The Obamas, and it's full of little details that reveal this man is not in any respect really of the people the way he is portrayed. For example, one little thing that popped to mind, he brought his Chicago chef with him to Washington. Chef? So, you know, they are not us, and we are not them. But it doesn't make any difference. It just doesn't matter. It's a very, very powerful image and such a desirable image. So this is the kind of person that we need to look for. Now, when I look at the roster of possibilities, Rubio is wonderful. Ted Cruz is interesting, senator from Texas. But somebody who I find intriguing, although I don't know how successful she can really be with all the baggage that she comes with, is Condoleezza Rice. Because she, obviously she's a minority, she's a woman, but she was the surprise star of the Republican convention. She gave a wonderful, wonderful speech. I can easily see Republicans of various stripes rallying enthusiastically around Condoleezza Rice, and it could make for an all-female battle for the presidency in 2016, because we know who's looming on the horizon. So, you know, it could be interesting.
I am a big Condoleezza fan, so I'm not in a position to make a
a balanced response to that. I mean, one of the striking statistics, apparently this election was the first where the Democrats led amongst Cuban Americans, and that again is something else, I suppose. I mean, even as an immigrant, even as a minority myself, I'm very uncomfortable with identity politics. But at the same time, it is such an undeniable fact. When you're talking about 93% of blacks voting for Obama, 71% of Hispanics, these are huge, huge statistics. And, you know, that has to be weighed into the consideration. But, yeah, I mean, I think the important thing for Republicans is to acknowledge that they did badly, but they did do catastrophically. Mm-hmm. And we've been invited now to break because my connection is getting a little bit dodgy, and that'll give us an opportunity to start talking about Israel. So we're just going to drop off for a minute and then come back in.
Okay. So obviously from our perspective over here, what's at the top of our minds is what the election result implies for the U.S.-Israeli relationship, of course. And I have to say that it's kind of ominous. It's very, very worrying. It is not entirely bleak necessarily. It could be, but there are certain things to be consoled by. But this is certainly not. It's a worrisome result. First of all, we have to think in terms of what President Obama has already done. The gifts that he gave the Palestinians of the 67 lines and settlement curtailment as preconditions for negotiations that were always supposed to be without preconditions. And we also remember quite vividly his, you know, conspicuous courtship of the Muslim world and apparent kind of lack of interest in Israel. There has been a lot of talk about his not visiting in the first term, which, if you look at it historically, is not at all unusual for first-term presidents, but it's a glaring omission considering his enthusiastic outreach to the Muslim world. Also, Damien, I don't know how much coverage this got in Britain, but there was a comical fiasco on the floor of the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, when God and Jerusalem, a reference to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, had been stripped from the Democratic platform, and the attempt was made to reinstate God and Jerusalem, and the crowd of delegates booed God, enthusiastically booing God. Amazing. And then it was reinstated above their objections. God and Jerusalem were put back in, despite the response of the delegates, and actually against the rules, by the way. After Obama intervened to say, put this language back in. But I simply cannot believe that he did not approve or at the very least know about the change in language ahead of time. Of course he knew what was in his own party platform. So, you know, this is not something that we should forget about. Also, we have to remember Obama's longstanding personal associations, which were never properly vetted the first time around and haven't really been mentioned the second time around by the media. His association with Rashid Khalidi, the radical academic, Samantha Power, of course, whose influence can clearly be seen in moves like his giving the Palestinians the option of demanding a settlement freeze. And then, of course, the fact that Obama no longer has any reason to court the Jewish vote, although how much of an issue is that? You know, he dipped to 69%. I don't think this is ever anything he's going to have to worry about, or Democrats in general are not going to have to worry about the Jewish vote for a long time. We can talk about that in a minute if you want. But also it's ominous because of Obama's apparent comfort with the assent of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think that this is not necessarily means that he's a fan of the Muslim Brotherhood, but I think that he is deeply, deeply reluctant to even opine about the choices other countries' populations make. I think it's an anti-colonialist view that is quite Carter-esque, and this is deep in his nature. Although we have to admit, you know, his style and his inclinations and his friendships even don't always coincide with his actions, when circumstances require it. The situation can change dramatically enough that he could wade in, but it's something that makes him deeply, deeply uncomfortable. One thing that I'll be keeping an eye on is if the question of Egyptian aid is ever going to come up. If he will ever place any contingencies on the enormous aid package that Egypt gets. So there, the positives that I would mention, one leaps to mind. We must not forget that the U.S. military relationship never wavered throughout Obama's first term, not even during the darkest moments between Bibi and Obama. This, of course, does not necessarily imply that things will continue this way, but it is a fact, and it must be acknowledged. To counter this, I will point out, you might remember in 2010, George Mitchell, Obama's Mideast peace envoy, threatened us with withholding our loan guarantees to pressure us back to the bargaining table. But here, on the third hand, this is not unique to Obama. George Bush Sr. did this to us in 1991. That's what got us to the Madrid peace talks. George Bush Jr. hinted that he might use this against us in 2003. Honestly, I think this is mostly the theater side of politics. What I really care about is the military relationship, which continues unabated.
And obviously, for good reasons, you're happy about that.
Of course. The American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was just here a couple of weeks ago. This kind of thing is very reassuring. And of course, obviously, we have a common interest regarding Iran. I think that Obama understand he is many things, but he is not a stupid man. And I think he does register the gravity of the Iranian threat.
Now, he has said on more than one occasion that he will not... It can't be tolerated. It is not acceptable for Iran to acquire a strategic nuclear weapon, a capability. And he has said that he will not rule out military action. Now, the question that people in Europe really want an answer to, but are unlikely to get, except when it happens, if it happens, is... will America intervene militarily directly? And do you have an answer? Do you have an instinct? Do you have a gut feeling? Do you think that the dirty work will be done by Israel if the dirty work needs to be done, if it is indeed dirty work?
Mm-hmm. First of all, the covert war against Iran is not going badly at all. There is no doubt in my mind. I have no evidence for this, and I have no information about it, but I am sure that the covert war is a joint American-Israeli covert war against Israel. Against Iran. I would say that the odds of an American of a dramatic physical American act against Iran is very, very small. But let me make one point, which is that it can be interpreted, since he said about the campaign and before the campaign he will not tolerate a nuclear Iran, the implication, you could say, of his being reelected is that he now has a mandate to act. I would say exactly the opposite is true. I would say the electorate who voted him in is not interested at all in foreign adventures, does not see at all how they are relevant to their own lives, doesn't care about their implications internationally or domestically, simply does not want to think about any of this. And Obama clearly recognizes this. In his victory speech, he used the phrase, I think it was, an end to the decade of war.
Right.
I do not believe that he has an American, a popular mandate to get into this. That's the first thing. The other thing is that I don't think it's advisable right now. Sanctions actually are biting in Iran. Ahmadinejad was just called before Parliament to explain the plummeting currency. If he doesn't appear or if he doesn't satisfy the parliamentarians, he might be impeached. There's also going to be an election in Iran in June. the situation could change. And Iran has an awful lot going on right now that it has to worry about with its Syrian ally collapsing. It might be strategically sensible simply to wait and see now. Waiting sometimes is leading from behind, but not always. Sometimes it's the smart thing to do. And I believe right now it's definitely the smart thing to do. So that's an incredibly long non-answer to your question. I think Obama desperately wants to avoid military action in Iran. I think Obama would love for us to take care of it for him because I think that he does recognize the seriousness of the situation. But I think, at the end of the day, I think he will do what's necessary because he usually does. Think about, Guantanamo is still open because it has to be open. It doesn't matter what he said. It doesn't matter what people want. There's something that he is ultimately practical. So I hope it doesn't come to this, but I think that he will still be with us at the end of the day. I hope so.
I mean, this is obviously as an outsider, something I find an interesting aspect of Obama's style, which is that he will start out as with Obamacare as with targeted killings, wanting to do the nice cuddly thing, as you might, as a Brit might put it, and then he'll come up against a hard reality and he'll sign the necessary documentation to get things done. And this is...
That's an interesting example because they also reflect his deep reluctance to get his hands dirty. Drone attacks are so clean. And they are rather unwise in the respect that obviously you're killing your enemy. You are not taking him. You are not learning anything from him. So he's compromising. It can be argued that the drone attacks compromise intelligence gathering. Who would have ever expected from the Obama who campaigned in 2008 that he would ever sanction something like targeted assassinations? So you're right. You're right. I mean,
And if you're an American conservative and you have already suspicion of the media, I think it is interesting. Well, put it this way, it's worth comparing mentally how a Republican president behaving the same way, authorizing the same level of targeted killings would be treated by the media compared to the way Obama is treated by the media. I think it's something that is a lot easier for somebody like him to do than it would be for a Republican.
Definitely. Well, that's an upside to Obama being reelected. we are going to need to close soon, but something that I'd like to do, Damien, that as we continue, I'd like to do this on a regular basis, is I just want to give our listeners a roundup of Rockets Roundup, what's been going on here, what's been launched at us over the last few weeks, because as far as I'm aware, this just doesn't seem to really get out there. No one seems to really know quite the extent of it, and I just wanted to run it down. In the month of October, 183 rockets were launched by Hamas from the Gaza Strip into sovereign Israel, into Israel. This started in the middle of the month, lasted for about a week. The first barrage lasted for about a week, all aimed at civilian areas in southern Israel, caused a lot of property damage, didn't kill anybody, but put some people into shock. Then on the 23rd, a platoon commander named Captain Ziv Shilon, was on a routine patrol on our side of the border fence with Gaza and was severely injured by an explosive device. Then on October 24th, the rocket attacks resumed and escalated with over 70 rockets hitting against civilian areas inside sovereign Israel within 14 hours. Two non-Israelis were severely injured when this happened. There are a lot of foreign workers who are at the farms down there, and unfortunately two of them were severely hurt. So that's the Rockets Roundup for this podcast, 183 rockets launched by Hamas into Israel in October. Damien, it's time to sign off. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Listeners, thank you so very much for being with us. I hope you'll be back. Stay safe, everybody. Go in good health. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Join the conversation.
You're raining tears. You're righteous, so righteous, you're out.